thank council for agreeing to start a little later this morning. And we now only have two arguments to hear. So we'll get to it. Council, we are familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs. We've looked at least portions of the record. So you should feel free in the limited time that's available to you, 15 minutes aside, to get straight to the heart of your argument. We don't need to be educated about the background. We know what the cases are about. We're probably going to have some questions. But be mindful of the traffic lights, and when the red light shines, it's time to stop. If you're answering a question from the court, feel free to finish your answer, but do be mindful of our time. We'll start with United States versus Hakeem. Mr. Ellis.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Andrew Ellis with the law firm Jones Day on behalf of appellant Salim Hakeem, and I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. In this appeal, we ask that this court make two rulings. First, that Mr. Hakeem's waiver of the right to counsel was invalid, and second, to reverse his conviction as a result. These two conclusions are amply supported by Supreme Court and 11th Circuit precedent, including at least two en banc decisions of this court. In contrast, the government asked this court to establish new rules and ignore binding precedent in at least three ways. First, the government effectively asked this court to rewrite its en banc decision in United States versus Gary and hold for the first time that a Faretta waiver that is based on the wrong maximum penalty can be valid. In Gary, this court provided two methods to effectuate a valid waiver. The first and the ideal method is to conduct a full Faretta colloquy. The second is available if the defendant obstructs the proceedings or does not provide clear answers to Faretta questions. And under that standard, the court should, and I quote, inform the defendant unambiguously of the penalties he faces if convicted and to provide him with a general sense of the challenges he is likely to confront as a pro se litigant. That's at page 10.
Before you get much further, I've got a question for you on something that we don't have precedent on that we've specifically reserved. And that is, since your client is making his objection, his Faretta objection, for the first time on appeal, do we review that question for plain error?
Your Honor, a few responses there. First, the government agrees that the de novo standard applies, and that is consistent with this court's precedent. In Gary, for example, the court provided or said that the de novo standard apply without stating that an objection was needed to preserve de novo review. In Cash, the court also used the de novo standard, and there's no indication, at least in the opinion, that the defendant there objected during or anywhere in the opinion. Third, I would direct this court's attention to the Supreme Court's decision in White versus Maryland. There, in a footnote, the court indicated there was no objection, but the failure to object, it essentially said, didn't matter, and it reversed the conviction because the defendant there did not have counsel at his arraignment. I think this rule is consistent also with Rule 51B of the Rules of Criminal Procedure. There, that rule is that if a party does not have an opportunity to object, the absent does not later prejudice that party.
Does it matter that this seems like, I know, it's been held open explicitly, but it seems like a case where perhaps there might be all the more reason to apply plain error since Mr. Hakeem did have counsel before his trial. I realize that the question of whether the deprivation of counsel earlier is a problem is a serious one, but he did have counsel at the district court level.
Your Honor, that's true. Our argument is two things in the alternative. First, that an objection was not required, and I think that's consistent with Cash, Gary, Rule 51B, as I've stated. And second, that nonetheless, objections were made by Mr. Hakeem throughout the proceedings. For example, in an objection to the R&R docket entry 23, Mr. Akeem, that he filed on his own, it said the affiant is not a pro se litigant. Throughout docket entry 47, the question was squarely before the court of whether it was okay for Mr. Akeem to proceed without counsel. And then the question was also, I believe, briefly raised at the plea hearing. And he also made various objections to being represented by Mr. Mendelson. So unlike, I think, maybe some other cases, this issue was squarely before the court, and I think the de novo standard thus should apply. Two cases address the situation squarely, Hammett from the 10th Circuit and Erskine from the 9th Circuit. There, the court said it really doesn't make sense to require a defendant to make a contemporaneous objection when they're told the wrong penalty. And I think that that reasoning should apply here.
Well, even the idea that there could that plain error might be the right standard would be inconsistent with the contemporaneous objection understanding of things, it seems to me, because what happens here and in these kinds of instances is the district court has made a finding of a knowing and voluntary waiver, and there would not be a contemporaneous objection, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
And if counsel were appointed much later, what we would really have to do if we were later to apply a plain error standard is what we would be saying is that later appointed counsel was somehow obliged to go back and raise not a contemporaneous objection, but an objection maybe long after the fact is here about that issue. So it's really incongruous and with not only how Stanley and Cash view it, but how other circuits have viewed it for that reason, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And briefly circling back to Judge Grant's question, it is true he was represented at counsel by trial, but the R&R, which said that he was proceeding pro se, any objections would have been due within 14 days. And during that entire period, Mr. Akeem did not have counsel.
Let me ask you a different question and shift from that for a moment. And this is a hypothetical counsel.
Sure.
Okay. I understand this is not our case. So let's say you have a district court misinform a defendant about the punishment, the penalties.
Sure.
You could, nevertheless, could you not have a record where it becomes, where it is apparent that notwithstanding that misinformation from the district court, the defendant was aware of what the actual penalty was?
I think that's true, Your Honor, and there's cases
and that would be a different case.
That would be a different case, and I think what really distinguishes this case from that hypothetical is, one, he was misinformed of the maximum penalty.
And there's nothing in this record to suggest that he knew the correct
penalty. Nothing in this record. And, I mean, so cases where someone decides to go pro se,
yeah,
right before trial, and they've been represented by defense counsel for 2 years, which is the case in some cases, you might think maybe there was a reasonable likelihood that that lawyer would have discussed the penalties, but that's not this case. Mr. Mendelson, he stated on the record that he had zero communication with Mr. Akeem. So
let me suggest a possible reason that it is not so clear that this defendant did not understand what the maximum penalty was. At that arraignment, it is true that the two, I don't consider them absolutely incorrect. I consider them ambiguous. He said, what we have is a misdemeanor, and it is not a felony that would mean imprisonment for more than a year. And he said that twice, in effect.
That's
but
right.
But also at that arraignment, the magistrate judge also said there were three counts. This fella had 3 years of college. He obviously knows three times one is three. Furthermore, then you get the change of plea hearing, and the magistrate judge clearly at that point told him that the maximum was 3 years, 1 year for each count. And we know that defendant did not change his mind about the only two important things that he had done up to that point. He did not change his mind about self-representation. He did not change his mind about pleading not guilty. So we know that when he knew all of the facts, he made the same decision. Going back, that's obviously relevant to harmless error, but it's also relevant, I think, to whether or not he understood, because beginning with the ambiguity of whether he understood or not, we now have some evidence, at least, that he did, in fact, understand, didn't make any difference. How do you respond?
A few responses, Your Honor. First of all, I think a fair read of the record does not actually support that Magistrate Judge Anon had fairly told him that he faced 3 years. To quote from the record, docket entry 13 at 9, he said, it's a criminal case, a Class A misdemeanor, meaning it's punishable by a potential term of imprisonment by up to 1 year. It seems to me in that sentence to scrutinize on the language, he's referring to the case. He's told 1 year of imprisonment. I think this was a mistake, plain and simple, by Magistrate Judge.
Are you talking about the arraignment?
This is at the arraignment, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And our argument, Your Honor, is that, you know, he self-represented himself at the arraignment under the Supreme Court's precedent in Hamilton, in White, in later decisions that affirm that that rule is still good law.
It is also true, however, that also at the arraignment at that, even though he twice said what you said, he also said that three counts.
Your Honor, I think it's unambiguous that he was told the wrong penalty. Now, even if there was some ambiguity in Gary, the court said that the trial court should unambiguously tell the defendant the penalty. So even if we assume it's ambiguous, which I think it's ambiguous at best.
How do you respond that you acknowledge, I assume, that the magistrate did tell him the 3 years at the change of plea hearing?
Slight correction, Your Honor. The change of plea was in front of District Judge Brown.
Okay.
We believe that that is at best still ambiguous for a few reasons. I mean, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that a waiver must be valid at the time it is made. That's from Stanley. And as I mentioned, it would be per se error for someone to represent themselves at the arraignment. So that's point number one.
But I think what Judge Anderson is saying is that the subsequent choice to go without counsel once the statement of the potential penalties was not ambiguous can inform our view of whether your client understood the penalty to start with.
A couple responses. First, when he was told that language, do you understand it's 1 year on each count, he said, I do not understand. We think that's reasonable for at least a couple reasons. First, that he was previously told he only faced 1 year. And I apologize, Your Honors, but if I may.
You may keep going.
And secondly, we don't expect lay people to understand the difference between a concurrent and consecutive sentencing. I think as lawyers looking at the transcript in hindsight, it may look clear to us, but for Mr. Akeem's perspective, which I think is what's critical here, he had previously been told the wrong penalty, and he's been all of a sudden told a different penalty altogether. And I think it is on the trial court to unambiguously tell the defendant how much time he faces. Just a second.
We're going to have more questions for you. Feel free to keep going.
Okay, Your Honor.
I want to ask about, it seems to me that Supreme Court decision in Coleman, at least implicitly held that a hearing pretty similar to this, although a critical stage, was not structural error. They implicitly held that because they remanded it and sent it back to determine whether it was harmless error. Is it not pretty clear for that reason, and also none of the reasons behind conclusion? concluding that something is structural error apply here. Is it not pretty clear that this is not structural error, and then furthermore, even if there is error, it's harmless here?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for a few reasons. First, in Gonzalez-Lopez, the Supreme Court there held the Sixth Amendment violation was structural, in part because many decisions by counsel, such as whether to cooperate, whether to plead, whether you're able to strike a plea deal, all happen before the trial. And the same situation is here. Mr. Akeem was left alone from the time of the arraignment till the time a few days before trial to decide whether to cooperate, to decide whether to try to strike a plea deal. And though it's all time where he did not have counsel advising him. And for that reason, this puts the kind of error there. And at time, I'm sorry, not only that he did not have counsel advising him, at a time when he believed, based on the error from the magistrate court, that the total maximum sentence that he faced was only 1 year. That puts the error here squarely in line with Gonzalez-Lopez. On the Coleman issue, Your Honor, Coleman, of course, was not an arraignment or a plea hearing, and the court there explained that there could be no prejudice because of a rule under the relevant procedure there. Hamilton and White have been reaffirmed multiple times, such as Chronic, footnote 25. And these are all after Coleman, in Bell v. Cohn. And in this court, sitting en banc in United States versus Gary, there was a decent amount of disagreement on the issue there, but there was much consensus on the rule that if you do not have counsel at an arraignment, it is per se error, citing to Hamilton and White. The main opinion cited that, and then so did, I think, two concurrences and two dissents. So we would disagree that Coleman somehow overruled Hamilton or White.
I understand it. So the period in which he was unrepresented included his arraignment when a plea was entered in his behalf.
Yes.
It included the period when the government extended to him a plea, right? A plea offer.
That's right.
It included another hearing at which he attempted to enter a change of plea based on a decision at which he had arrived on his own without the assistance of standby counsel. Right.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the real question is it not, is that whether those stages of the process were critical. So if they were critical stages, then it's structural error. That's your argument, right?
That's our argument, Your Honor, and I think that's supported by the Supreme Court cases that we cited. And Judge Anderson, I would slightly dispute something that you said. At the change of plea hearing, we still think it was ambiguous over what the total sentence was, but leaving that to aside, he did shortly after that decide to be represented by counsel, and at the change of plea hearing, he changed his mind from deciding to plead guilty to deciding at the end to not enter a plea of guilty. And it seems like the total sentence could absolutely impact that decision.
And so he was told initially it's a criminal case, a Class A misdemeanor, meaning it's punishable by a potential term of imprisonment of up to 1 year. And then during the arraignment, the magistrate said, this is again a Class A misdemeanor. So we're not talking about a felony involving imprisonment beyond 1 year.
Right.
And that's the extent to which he was informed of the possible punishment.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I know I'm way over, so
you haven't lost anything because you've been answering our questions.
One more point on the plain error question. I know we specifically reserved that question in the U.S. v. Stanley case and noted that at least the Fourth Circuit has said that plain error applies in this situation, in this type of a situation. The Sixth Circuit has said that cases in that circuit have gone both ways, and the Ninth Circuit has said that plain error review would be inappropriate. So I just want to clarify, I don't think it's fair to say that all the circuits that have spoken to this have said that plain error review would not be appropriate.
I apologize if I said that, Your Honor. What I was trying to say is that at least when this court has spoken, it is consistently applied de novo, even when an objection was not lodged. And then I think the reasoning, even if the reasoning in those cases it wasn't spelled out, makes sense for a couple reasons. First of all, it doesn't make sense to ask someone right after they waive the right to counsel to then object to say that waiver was not knowing. And I don't think we actually expect for example, Mr. Mendelson, he was appointed a few days before trial. It is not on him to review every single prior transcript to see if there's some error, such as being told the wrong penalty. And in fact, under the local rules and the scheduling order here, Mr. Akeem had until 14 days after to object to the R&R, which stated he was going pro se, which he actually did. So I at the risk of repeating myself, we believe that plain error should not apply, but even if an objection was required, Mr. Akeem did lodge that objection throughout the proceeding.
Yeah. Thank you.
By my count, I counted Ducton from the Fourth Circuit in 2015, Erskine from the Ninth Circuit in 2004, Hammett from the Tenth Circuit this past year. It's all applying a de novo standard. And the Sixth Circuit saying in McBride, our sister circuits, including us in Kimball, uniformly apply a de novo standard of review, right?
Yeah, so I think that's the correct standard.
Are there
standard.
Any other circuits I'm missing?
Those are the ones that I'm aware of. This question was, as you know, was not briefed, but we'd be happy to brief that question for you. But I think,
all right, I was just asking what you knew of.
Yeah, those are the cases I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
You saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Davis.
Sorry.
It's okay. I have my doubts about that requirement that we adopted a long time ago, and maybe revisiting it with the clerk's office at the end of this week. Seems funny to me that you're required to put that thing on a microphone, which means you're going to touch it after someone else has been up there and just touched it. I'm not exactly sure what we think we're accomplishing there, but we're going to do what we have to do in the meantime.
Thank you. May it please the court, Gregory Davis for the United States. There are four issues that the court that are raised by this appeal. Did the magistrate judge correctly determine that a monologue, a Feretta-like monologue, was appropriate? Did the magistrate judge correctly find that the defendant waived his right knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his right to appeal? If the court erred in that, is that error subject to harmless error review? And fourth, if it is subject to harmless error review, was the error harmless? Very briefly.
Of course, I look at it as maybe just simply when a defendant has been told incorrect information about the possible punishment, has been misinformed what the maximum punishment is, and the misinformation is to tell him that it's a third of what the maximum punishment is, can the waiver, and there's nothing else in the record to suggest that he knew, in fact, what the correct punishment was at the time.
There is not.
Yeah, and so in that sense, it seems, I don't see how that can be anything other than error. To conclude that it was knowing and voluntary, where the only information we have is that he was misinformed what the possible punishment was.
Well, under Fitzpatrick, the eight-factor test.
Let me tell you what I think about the eight-part test. I think it's one thing if you have someone who has been correctly told information, for example, and they're an intelligent, educated layman, right, versus someone who is not as educated, not as intelligent, maybe has suffered some kind of mental health issues. There could be any number of things that would affect their understanding of correct information. But it seems to me, at least, that our precedents say that if you are just not aware of what the correct information is about the punishment, that we don't even get into those eight factors. It can't be knowing and voluntary in that circumstance. What am I missing?
I would just point out that, as Judge Anderson pointed out in Stanley, the court says that it's possible for the it's permissible for the court to look at what happens later as evidence of what the of what was true at the time of the particular at the time of the waiver. I understand the court's concern. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, forgetting what happens later for just a second, I was trying to ask about the eight factors.
I understand.
And because that's what you had brought up. And it just seemed to me that if you're told false information about the punishment, then the eight factor inquiry, where you're trying to make sure that this person's understanding of the correct information led to a knowing and voluntary waiver. It makes sense to use the eight factors in that context, but when you're just told false information, you don't even get to those weighing of factors.
Right. In Gary and in Talley and in Hall, which the 28J letter that we submitted yesterday, this court explains sort of how things are different when a defendant is, when the defendant is not cooperative, when the defendant when it's impossible to have a standard Faretta colloquy, then the court looks at different factors. Certainly one of the factors that the court has stated very clearly is the defendant aware of the possible punishment? So I understand the court's difficulty. The government recognizes that the court's cases have provided a bit of an obstacle for the government in
yeah. Yeah, Molinari versus Smith seems to me old precedent, but still good precedent, as best I can tell, seems to be a problem for you.
Right. So because the court has essentially said that if you're going to proceed in a Freda-like monologue, you need to correctly state the maximum penalty,
yeah,
it may be prudent for me to jump to why the error was harmless.
Let me ask you one question before you do that. I gathered from an answer you made to Chief Judge Pryor that it is you are not taking the position that that the arraignment was unclear. It seemed to me you answered him that it was clear that there was a incorrect statement, and therefore you are not relying at all, I gather, on the fact that the magistrate judge also said that there were three counts.
If I said that, that was a mistake. I agree with your point to opposing counsel that the statement was incomplete. The magistrate judge correctly stated that the maximum penalty for a willful failure to file is 1 year of imprisonment. The court also made it clear that there were three counts. So as you said, the defendant with 3 years of college can multiply 1 times 3 and get to a 3-year.
Okay, go ahead to the structural error that you were going. I just wanted to see whether you made that concession.
No. I agree with your Honor's point. But I did not get the impression that the Chief Judge was as willing to listen to your point as I was.
Well, you got to argue to the panel. I can only speak for myself. You did concede in your brief that the magistrate judge did not expressly tell the defendant at the arraignment that he faced a possible maximum sentence of 3 years.
That's correct. He did not expressly
tell that. And in fact, what he also said was that we're not talking about imprisonment of more than 1 year.
He said that as well.
Okay.
In terms of why this error is not structural, the Supreme Court has made clear in Altamonte that most errors, including constitutional errors, are subject to review for harmlessness.
But Sixth Amendment errors are ordinarily a pretty big exception to that, right?
Certain Sixth Amendment errors are. That's correct.
And one of them is if you're without counsel, if you are proceeding without counsel, without it being a knowing and voluntary waiver, at critical stages of the proceedings, right?
Correct. But none of the stages here were critical in the sense that the defendant suffered a prejudicial consequence.
So he was unrepresented at his arraignment.
He was.
He was unrepresented when the government extended to him a plea offer.
Correct.
And we're at a hearing where he attempted to change his plea without anything that standby counsel had said on his own.
Well, he said he intended to change his plea, but as any review of that hearing will show, it was nothing. It was certainly not a change of plea as we would understand it.
My only point is, you take all those things together, it's hard for me to say there wasn't this was not a critical stage of the proceeding.
Well, if you look at the Supreme Court's the cases in White and was it the Maryland versus?
What about Fry and Roy and Molinaro? What do they say about these stages? I mean, arraignment, extension of a plea offer. You're saying these aren't critical stages?
Well, arraignment in the state court cases, the case from Maryland and the case from Alabama, those were critical stages because certain things were lost. In one of the cases from Alabama, by not having counsel and by entering a plea, the defendant lost certain defenses that otherwise would have been available. If you don't raise them at the time of the arraignment under Alabama law, you couldn't raise them later. Under federal law, an arraignment is simply the time to enter a plea and to start the proceedings.
Yeah, but doesn't White say that a hearing where a plea is taken when you have no counsel, that's a critical stage?
But the plea was a guilty plea. There's a consequence to pleading guilty that is very different than a consequence to pleading not guilty.
Doesn't the government offer plea deals because it can benefit the defendant to have less time in prison, and it can benefit the government by not having to go through the trouble of the trial? I mean, he potentially lost the time to get the opportunity to receive a lower sentence, right?
It's possible.
The problem I have that may ultimately be the problem you have is that this particular defendant was apparently uniquely committed to being difficult because of his ideological views about various matters. In my opinion, it would not have mattered if the judge had told him correctly what his sentence was. However, I don't see anywhere in our precedent that we get to make room for uniquely difficult defendants and create a special category of error for them. Tell me why I'm wrong. I'm open to it.
Well, speaking sort of from a policy standpoint, the defendant, if the defendant prevails here, he's entitled to a retrial with counsel. That's exactly what he had. In his prayer for release, he asks for an acquittal, but I don't see, I am not familiar with any basis whereby he could get an acquittal on appeal for this particular case.
Couldn't he get another opportunity for a plea deal? I mean, at this point, it probably wouldn't make sense given how long he's already served, but theoretically, couldn't he have that opportunity?
Certainly, he could have an opportunity to do it again. It's just, practically speaking, it just doesn't make a lot of logical sense. I understand.
Yeah. That kind of goes to the whether, a reversal because an error is structural makes practical sense, right? But if it really is structural, we can't look at that, can we?
If the court determines that this is a structural error, then no, the court cannot look at that.
Yeah.
The court is bound by structural error precedent. I would point out that in Satterwhite versus Texas, the Supreme Court made clear that counsel error, a Sixth Amendment error is only structural if it infects the entire proceeding. This did not infect the entire proceeding because, as we point out, the defendant had counsel at trial. And also at none of the points where he was running, where he didn't have counsel, he was not missing counsel at the time he pled guilty. He was not missing counsel at a time he was sentenced. Those are different kinds of situations. So I think under Satterwhite, the court needs to look at the whole, it needs to take a broader view. And if you look at the,
this is what White says. Supreme Court says in White that a plea hearing is a critical stage. We do not stop to determine whether prejudice resulted because only the presence of counsel could have enabled the accused to know all the defenses available to him and to plead intelligently.
But I think you still need to look at the facts underlying the decision in White. And the problem there is because the plea had significant consequences, prejudicial consequences, that's a stage that's critical in under state law. It is not, an arraignment is different.
It's not just an arraignment here, though.
No.
He's unrepresented at the arraignment where he pleads not guilty. He's unrepresented when a plea offer is extended to him. He's unrepresented at a later hearing when he attempts a plea change. It's hard for me to say that when you take all that together that we could say he was not without counsel at a critical stage. What am I missing?
I'm really not sure what I can add beyond the essentially at no point when there were prejudicial consequences for him, mm-hmm. he had counsel at the time when there were prejudicial consequences, which is at trial and at sentencing.
Let me introduce this question by saying I'm not saying that this is our conclusion or will be our conclusion. We haven't conferenced, so do not make the assumption that I'm asking you because this is what the answer is. But let's say that we decided here that the magistrate incorrectly described the maximum possible sentence, and then that leads to structural error. How should we describe the nature of an error that is required? I'm not saying that as clearly as I wish I would. Here, if we conclude he was told the maximum penalty was 1 year, it was 3. That's a significant difference. He was told the incorrect penalty. What if he was told that the maximum sentence was, say, 2.5 years? Or let's say that someone's maximum sentence was 30 years, and there was an incorrect calculation and the defendant was told that it was 28 years. How should we describe what renders a sentence advisory incorrect as opposed to ambiguous or somewhat incorrect? Or do you see the line I'm trying to draw? Here, I think, you know, three times higher is probably pretty significant no matter how you measure it. But in other cases, I think it could be closer. How would we define that?
That is a very hard question. It's a question of degree, and I'm not sure the best way to answer that question that does not make the waters even muddier than they already are.
I'm going to ask opposing counsel, too, just so you know. So if you have a view, you may want to get it in there. If you don't, that's okay.
I do. I mean, it's a hard question to answer because it presumes that any kind of error. The only logical answer would seem to be that unless it's a de minimis error. So, for example, if the maximum sentence is 12 months and he was told 13 months, it's very difficult to see how that type of an error would qualify.
Would maybe material be the right word rather than de minimis?
I think material probably is a better word than de minimis, yes.
Have our cases ever made that distinction or suggested that there is such a distinction?
Not that I'm aware of. As we point out in our brief, there are a couple of other circuits that have upheld findings that a waiver was knowing, despite the fact that the defendant was misadvised of the maximum. I mean, one was told a maximum of, I think, 10 years. It was actually 125 years. One around, I think, 80 months, and it was actually twice that. So the cases are sort of all over the place in that regard.
The problem is, as early as 1948, the Supreme Court said to be valid, waiver must be made with an apprehension of the nature of the charges, the statutory offenses included with them, and the range of allowable punishments thereunder. In later cases, the Supreme Court has said, the defendant may be allowed to proceed pro se. He must be warned specifically of the hazards ahead. Freda itself says that he has to know what he's doing and his choice is made with eyes open. That's my concern about these kind of material distinctions.
I understand, Your Honor, and I'm not sure that there's anything I can do to assuage that concern.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Ellis.
I'll just address a few points and then conclude. Your Honor, I'll start where Judge Grant, where you said you wish there was a standard for uncooperative defendants. In my view, that standard has been created in United States versus Gary. Gary set out two standards, either a full Feretta hearing or a Feretta-like hearing in the case of obstructive defendants. The magistrate judge obviously went with that Feretta-like standard here, but under that standard, the court should unambiguously tell the penalties faced if convicted. That didn't happen here, so under either standard, the conviction is invalid, and we don't think a third standard should be created. Second, the government argues that...
So under that case, Gary,
yeah,
it wouldn't matter whether it was ambiguous. It has to be unambiguous.
That's right, Your Honor. It needs to be unambiguous because we expect that it's on the trial court to make sure that the defendant knows what he's doing with eyes open, and it needs to be
unambiguous. Which means, of course, that in a situation like this, the district court simply cannot allow the defendant to proceed without counsel. self-representation. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I think that Gary, and quoting Von Molk at one point, it says, to be valid, such waiver must be made without, among other things, the range of allowable punishments. That's the bare minimum. They need to know the charges, the range of allowable punishments. Always get that right. Sorry, Your Honor.
That's at page 1266. At 1267, Gary said this, when confronted with a defendant who refuses to provide clear answers to questions regarding his Sixth Amendment rights, it is enough for the court to inform the defendant unambiguously of the penalties he faces if convicted. That's the language we used, right?
Right. So I think both the government would effectively ask this court to ignore either the quote of Von Molk from 1948 or the rule that I believe was set down there. Second, the government argues that the fact that Mr. Hakim had counsel at trial obviates any error, but that is just not true based on Supreme Court precedent. For example, Missouri v. Fry, the Supreme Court said it is insufficient simply to point to the guarantee of a fair trial as a backstop that inoculates any errors in the pretrial process. That's at 143 to 44. Hamilton, of course, involved a defendant that was represented at trial, but because he was not represented at arraignment, it was per se error. Also, I think that the government misreads Hamilton. It's not whether something was irretrievably lost, it's whether something may be irretrievably lost. If the standard is something was irretrievably lost, that's a prejudice standard. And I see I'm over. May I?
I'm not sure we need more.
Okay.
I'll give you 30 seconds.
Okay. I appreciate that, Your Honor. Under Hamilton, it said what happens there may affect the whole trial. So I think the standard is clear from Hamilton and White and later reaffirmed. It's per se error without looking to whether something was actually irretrievably lost. And as we've detailed in some length, something was irretrievably lost. The ability to cooperate, a plea deal, to whether to plead guilty, all happened when Mr. Hakim, one, thought the sentence was only 1 year, and two, that he did not have counsel.
Thank you. We'll move to our last case, Vital Pharmacy.